It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later, we talk with amazing race winner and UW food science student Maya Warren about the science behind ice cream and her dream to track the world's greatest frozen desserts.
First, one of the more controversial aspects of Governor Walker's proposed state budget is a significant change to the state's Department of Natural Resources. His proposal calls for the elimination of about 18 positions in the DNR's Bureau of Science Services.
Now, according to a new story published by the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, the agency is considering going a step further, and administrators with the DNR are considering eliminating the Bureau of Science Services altogether. So what's going on at the DNR? Why does this scientific bureau keep finding itself in hot water?
Joining us now is the reporter behind that story. Ron Seeley is with the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Ron, thanks a lot for joining us.
Sure, no problem.
So the governor intended to cut staff from the Bureau of Science Services in his budget proposal, and now you're reporting on the possible elimination of that bureau. And this isn't something that the DNR has been talking openly about. How did you get this information?
Yeah, we had been hearing longtime sources at the agency, and I don't think it's any great secret that they're is unhappiness among some of the longtime staffers there and the natural resource personnel about some of the directions the agency's taken. And soon after it was announced, the budget was announced, and these position cuts were announced, we had picked up on some discussion within the agency that there was a plan to really enact those cuts and put them into place, but go much further than that by actually dissolving the bureau, which has about a total of 55 employees, researchers, and analysts, and so forth, and absorb those positions, move those remaining positions into divisions, management divisions within the agency. You'd move, for instance, a wildlife ecologist perhaps into the wildlife management division, and basically disassemble the independent bureau. And that's important. The bureau has in the past been independent and has been able to pursue its own research goals independent of those other divisions and the management of the agency.
Scott Hull is the director of the agency's Office of Business Support, and you quote him in your piece as saying the move is being considered to address, here's the quote, the legislative perception of research not being well aligned with program needs. So legislative perception,
yeah,
saying it's not aligned. What's your read on what that means?
Yeah, I think that refers, actually we know it refers to one particular individual who has been in the headlines is Senator Tom Tiffany, Republican from Hazelhurst, and he's been openly critical of the Bureau of Science, was especially critical of the Bureau after it released a report on some of the environmental concerns surrounding the proposed taconite mine, the Gogebe taconite mine that has since been, it's now off the table and the company has withdrawn its plan. But Tiffany felt that the report issued by the Bureau was biased against the mine and let it be known that he wasn't happy about that. He's also criticized the Bureau for studying and doing research related to climate change, which, and basically, he was quoted in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, for example, as saying that he doesn't want the Bureau studying something that remains theoretical.
Can you tell us more about what exactly it is the Bureau of Science Services does at the DNR? What sort of research do they conduct?
Sure. I encourage people to take a look at our story at wisconsinwatch.org, and there are a few links in the story, and one of the most interesting links, I think, will take you to the long list of studies and research reports that have been issued by these scientists. In the past, the agency's research and its science arm has been tremendously respected for the breadth of its science, and they study a lot of things people don't even realize. These are folks who are out doing surveys of wildlife populations, even wildlife populations that we don't know a lot about, like mussels and freshwater mussels and streams. They're studying invasive species and the spread of invasive species across the state. They're studying things related to chronic wasting disease and the spread of chronic wasting disease. Just a really broad a number of subjects that not only have to do with the state of our natural resources and the state of our landscape, which, you know, which is very important to people here in Wisconsin, but also have bearing on our health also, I believe.
We're talking with Ron Seeley, reporter and editor with the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, about possible changes coming to the DNR with the possible elimination of the Bureau of Science Services. And one question that comes up is this bureau has been a target of both politicians and some DNR administrators. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that obviously from Aquino's comment, there are administrators now, and you have to remember that the administrators at the DNR now are largely political appointees, and many of them don't have a natural resource background, and those appointees are deep within the agency now. And you know, the other thing I think is that there are people within the agency who do believe that the science can still be accomplished without the independent bureau that is drawing has drawn so much fire from some inside and outside the agency and the legislature and in the agency itself. Their argument is that, you know, you can have these folks within these divisions still doing the same kind of research that they do in the independent bureau. The argument against that is when you remove the scientist independence, you do remove their ability to do science that will be viewed as objective and, you know, not carrying out a particular division's agenda. In other words, policy. Some people believe science won't drive policy any longer. It'll be the other way around. Policy will drive the science.
One concern that some critics of this possible move have is that the effect it could have on the data trove that this bureau has been gathering over the years. Can you flesh out that concern? What are people saying?
Yeah, I think, and that's one that some people have mentioned that. In fact, I think Secretary Stepp has said, "Well, we can rely on the UW for research." Well, ironically, the UW relies heavily on the DNR and to collect data that is used in research, more basic research that's done at the university. The DNR has been really known for its collection of data, its monitoring, its surveys of deer populations, which are tremendously important for the hunting public and for control of diseases like chronic wasting disease in the deer herd. They do similar surveys of all wildlife populations, fish and bird populations. They do surveys of air quality, and all that data is kept, and there are data banks at the DNR that go back years and years, and science gets done by you know, putting together reports that rely on that long accumulation of data, and there's some concern that will go by the wayside or that those won't be maintained any longer without an independent bureau.
Now that your report is out, are DNR administrators responding to this story, confirming or denying anything?
Haven't heard much. Of course, you know, I called and sought comment from officials within the agency. Dealt primarily with Bill Kosh, the lead spokesperson for the agency. Explained to him that I felt that you know, perhaps there were legitimate reasons for making this move, and there are some within the agency who sincerely believe that they can continue to do the science in a way that will benefit and protect the state's natural resources. And they basically refuse to allow any of the agency folks to talk about this or to have someone go on record. I just ended up quoting Kosh on saying that, you know, they don't feel the science is going to change and the science is going to be as important as ever.
And what do you see happening next in this story? Will the DNR be waiting for the budget to be finalized before taking action?
Yeah, I think, and again, this was made clear in the exchange, and certainly Aquino made clear in his memo that this is not a done deal, that there are still other, you know, options being discussed. So I don't think it's a sure thing that we're going to see the Bureau disappear. I think there are still options on the table. Kosh made clear that, you know, no decisions have been made yet on this, that it is one of a number of options being considered to deal or to reorganize at least the the science bureau within the agency.
Ron, thanks so much for joining us.
Sure, no problem.
That was Ron Seal, reporter and editor at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. He joined us to talk about the possible elimination of the DNR's Bureau of Science Services.
It's time for Wisconsin Life. Most people look forward to spring, the warm weather, the bird songs, the flowers. Writer Ben Percy understands the appeal, but finds the starkness of winter ideal for storytelling.
You're probably looking forward to spring. The bird song. The trees leafing out and the tulips pressing through the mud. The green music of it all. I get it. But I'll miss winter in the upper Midwest. Not just the skiing and snowshoeing and Norwegian sweaters and the stark beauty of it all, but the way it turns me inward. Maybe it comes from that old impulse to gather close to the fire and stare quietly at the flames snapping and the logs burning down to ashes. But when the trees are skeletal, when the windows are cataract with ice, when the yard is shrouded white, I do my best writing. As if from the gray-bellied clouds, like snow, fall the best stories. Some of them shared with my children. December through February, it is often dark and petrifyingly cold when my kids catch the bus down the road. So I drive them the 100 yards and we wait in the wintry gloom together. Sometimes we have 5 minutes, sometimes 10, and I fill the silence with stories. There was the story of the strange staticky whispers that played from every phone and television and radio station and made all the adults go blank-faced and wander off into the woods, leaving the children behind, a twist on the Pied Piper. There was the story about a large lump in the snow, like a massive molehill, a lump that moved, that burrowed about, that sucked down squirrels and rabbits and teachers on playground duty into a white oblivion. Fairy tales, all of them. The town where they take place is always a shadow version of where we live, and the children who save the day are always shadow versions of my own. I speak slowly and with theatrical flair, often with no idea where the story is going. Snow feathers the windshield and wind shakes the car, and my son and daughter's eyes go wide, their faces greened by the dash lights. The stories are serialized, sometimes going on for weeks. When I spot the long yellow coffin of the bus rolling toward us, I often rush out a cliffhanger. And then they heard a strange noise in the woods. Or, and then the door crashed open and a man entered the room with his face wrapped in bandages. They often beg me to keep going, even as the bus pulls up with its red lights flashing. Tune in next time, I normally say, and send them off. But the other morning, with the warm breath of spring on my face and some sadness in my voice, I said, tune in next winter.
Ben Percy is the author of several books, including his most recent, The Deadlands. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council, with additional support coming from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more info, visit wisconsinlife.org.
While winter may be ideal for storytelling, spring is perfect for indulging in a cool, delicious treat like ice cream. And since we love to eat it, someone's got to make it.
UW food science researcher Maya Warren knows the secrets of creating a perfect gelato, but what she's really passionate about are the properties that make things like gelato and ice cream and all those other winter desserts or frozen desserts awesome. As a recent co-winner of CBS's reality show The Amazing Race, she plans to draw on both her television experience and food science background to explore the world's best frozen desserts.
Maya Warren is with us now. She's a PhD student in food science at UW-Madison, specializing in the science of ice cream. Maya, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you all very much. I'm so happy to be here.
So what an incredible career. I don't know. I guess we should have all thought of that. Ice cream scientist. Although in my case, scientist would mean one who eats ice cream. How did you get enthused about the science behind ice cream?
You know, I've always been a person who's loved ice cream ever since I was a little girl. I had, you know, a little ice cream maker and a little easy bake oven. And, you know, for me, being a chemist in college, I looked to, you know, combine those skills into something that I would love. And I mean, who doesn't love ice cream? And so I told myself, I'm going to do what I love and love what I do for the rest of my life. And, well, ice cream was it.
Now, as a food scientist, what are some of the coolest things you've discovered about ice cream?
So some of the coolest things, I like that, pun intended, some of the coolest things that I discovered about ice cream are that not all ice creams melt the same. And so most people think, oh, because ice cream, you know, when it's on a cone, it just looks like it's melting and we're eating it so fast. They don't always all melt the same. And one of the main ingredients in ice cream is air. It's kind of deceiving, right? You don't think of air as a main ingredient, but it actually is. And for us in the industry, that's a really, really great thing because, you know what? Air is free. So we really like having air in ice cream. And another thing about ice cream, the number one flavor still?
Vanilla.
Vanilla. You got it right. Still the number one flavor.
Does that surprise you at all? Why do people like vanilla so much?
I think people like vanilla because vanilla is actually a lot more complex than we think it is. I mean, there's a Mexican vanilla, bourbon vanilla, and Indonesian vanilla, and all of them have different, and those are just a few of them, they all have different flavor components and compounds that come out in different ways. And so I actually really, really, really love vanilla, but I'm a really big lover of a lot of like particulates, like nuts and fruits and cookies in my ice cream. But a good vanilla, I mean, you really can't go wrong.
I was going to say, like, I like, if I have vanilla, I put lots of those things in it myself,
right,
or
right.
I just get it already there. I was wondering, in the food science world, are there, like, purists? Like, no, it must be pure vanilla ice cream and no adulterant materials.
I mean, there definitely are some people who, you know, only use vanilla and not, like, vanillin, which is, like, an artificial vanilla. And you can definitely, well, most people who are in the food industry can probably tell the difference because vanillin tastes a bit different than vanilla. And those are key things when you're looking at different ice cream products. Your higher end ice cream products will have the true real vanillas in them versus your lower end, like your economy brands would have kind of like those vanilla substitutes.
So onto your project of exploring the world's frozen desserts, which countries and desserts are on your list?
So right now, you know, I would love to be able to go to India. I mean, India has a dessert called Kulfi, which will be very, very interesting to explore, you know, the culture behind it, the science behind it, the love and the passion and the ingredients. I mean, when you think of India and all of the complex flavors that occur within the food itself, I mean, think about what they can do with ice cream, like cardamom. Oh, that just sounds so delicious right now. And, you know, why not go to Israel and try like halva? You know, I don't really know much about it, but I'm looking to explore. And so as an ice cream scientist, if I don't know much about it, I'm assuming most of America doesn't either. So why not have people kind of travel with you while they're on their couch and explore the ins and outs of frozen desserts around the world?
I know gelato from Italy, mm-hmm. making inroads here in the U.S. Do you think some of these other international frozen desserts, ice cream relatives could be big here someday too?
You know, you never know. It definitely is a possibility. You know, in the American culture, we treat ice cream as just, you know, another snack. In other countries, ice cream and frozen desserts are more of a delicacy. So if we treat it as like a different kind of product, then maybe the market would be ready for it. But I mean, I'll admit, I love a good old-fashioned scoop of ice cream. So, and there's sometimes nothing like it.
And we've been using the terms frozen dessert and ice cream. Does ice cream have a particular definition that makes it ice cream?
Oh, Veronica, such a great question. So in the United States, we actually do have a legal definition of ice cream. And to keep it simple, ice cream in the United States must have 10% or more milk fat. Must. In other countries, people use, you know, different kinds of oils. So your safflower oil, your coconut, your palm kernel, and those different oils have different type of freezing properties compared to milk fat. So as a result, you're going to end up with a different microstructure. As mentioned before, I study the structure and microstructure of ice cream and frozen desserts. And so when I say frozen desserts, I can't just generalize it as ice cream because, for instance, gelato is not ice cream, according to the U.S. definition.
So you're going by the legal definition here.
Right. Definitely. Definitely.
So you and Amazing Race co-owner Amy DeYoung are giving a talk about women in science, your experiences on The Amazing Race. How bright is science as a career for women? Why would you recommend it for women to get into?
You know, as being a woman in science, it's definitely a field that, you know, women are still underrepresented, and it's such a strong field for women to go into because as women, I mean, we bring skill sets that men, no offense to men in general, but we bring different skill sets that men don't necessarily bring to the plate. And so why not be able to go out there and have young ladies be able to look up to people like Amy and myself and say, you know what, we can be food scientists too. That's something that we can do, and actually look at something that's very applicable and something that they can get into. And I mean, let's admit, a lot of people love food, so, and most of us tend to love to eat it, so, you know, why not explore that as a as actual career opportunity? So I encourage all young girls to go out there, and young boys in general, to go out there and explore fields that they really love.
And before we let you go, I understand you have a signature flavor that you make yourself of ice cream. What is it?
I do. I call it double buttered candied pecan. It's the base is 15% milk fat, so it definitely fits the legal definition of ice cream. And it has a Mexican and bourbon vanilla in it. And then I freeze it and has about 40% overrun, which is the air in the ice cream. And I dump in a whole bunch of candied buttered pecans, and it is, oh my gosh, so good.
That sounds yummy. Well, Maya, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Maya Warren, graduate student in food science at the UW-Madison, specializing in the science of ice cream. She and lab mate Amy DeYoung won last season's edition of the CBS reality show The Amazing Race.
April is Alcohol Awareness Month, and Wisconsin has a widely acknowledged drinking problem. Compared to every other state, this Wisconsin has the highest percentages of people who are drinkers, binge drinkers, and drunken drivers.
Today we're going to focus on drunken driving. According to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, in a 2009 report, over 26% of Wisconsin adults admitted that they drove under the influence in the past year.
Wisconsin is the only state in the country where a first drunk driving offense is not actually a crime, but a traffic ticket. In the last legislative session, lawmakers moved to toughen Wisconsin's drunk driving laws, but despite broad bipartisan support, those laws didn't pass. Virtually every proposal to toughen drunken driving laws failed in 2013 and 2014.
Bill Leaders joins us now. He's a reporter and editor at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Welcome, Bill.
Good to be here.
And in a bit, we'll be joined later by Senator Tim Carpenter, who co-sponsored drunk driving legislation last year. And Bill, can you give us a recap about some of this legislation that was introduced and that ultimately failed last year in the session?
There were more than a dozen bills introduced last session which would have toughened the penalties for driving drunk in Wisconsin. A package of bills, about six bills, I believe, were introduced by a couple of Republican co-sponsors, Alberta Darling in the Senate and Jim Ott in the Assembly, and they were supported by Tim Carpenter, a Democrat, in the Senate. So they did have some bipartisan support. The fact that they came from the Republican side made many people think that they would have a chance of passing. Some of these bills were pretty modest. It were things like requiring that everyone who is charged with first offense drunk driving has to make a court appearance. Now it's possible in some cases that you don't even have to show up in court. Other ones would have toughened the penalties for repeat offenders. It would have established mandatory minimum penalties for drivers who cause injury and death. None of that passed. Some of these bills did receive some debate. Some of them passed the Assembly, but none of the package of bills passed the Senate. And I spoke with Senator Fitzgerald, the majority leader, who explained that, you know, there was some disagreement among his members as to the best thing to do, whether tougher laws were the way to go. Wisconsin has seen a significant reduction in drunk driving fatalities and crashes, and he points to that, and he felt that the path that needed to be pursued was the one bill which did pass last session, which was to provide more money for these treatment courts, which try to address drunk driving by providing treatment to offenders.
Now, to look more closely at that package of bills authored by Republican Senators Alberta Darling and Representative Jim Ott, and again, these are two Republicans in a Republican-controlled legislature with some bipartisan support, with also public support. What is the thinking on why they ultimately didn't pass with that behind them?
Well, I think it is the point that Senator Fitzgerald made, is that there is disagreement as to whether making the laws tougher, making the penalties higher, was the right thing to do. There was also some fiscal estimates that were submitted regarding some of these bills, which talked about, you know, huge amounts of additional costs the state would incur. Now, this was disputed by advocates for these changes. It said those cost estimates were overblown. It assumed that in every case there would be significant additional jail time that and prison time that was attached to sentences, and that's the only way the numbers would be that high. Whereas in the way they saw it is toughening the penalties would also have the effect of discouraging the behavior, so there would be fewer people who would be locked up under these heightened penalties.
What are the latest trends in drunken driving rates in Wisconsin?
Well, they have been going, fatalities have been going down over the last decade. It used to be more than 300 people a year were killed in drunken driving accidents in Wisconsin. That went down to about 200 people a year. In 2013, it was 185, and there were more than 2,000 people who were injured, but it had gone down. I have not found numbers for 2014, but the point has been made, and the governor made this point when I did the story. I received some comment from him that, you know, the state has achieved successes in reducing drunken driving rates, and that's part of the reason why there isn't more support for some changes, like making first offense drunken driving a crime. That is something that the Democrats introduced independent of this package of Republican bills, and I don't believe it even had a hearing. It went nowhere. It was dead on arrival. There was no legislative interest in pursuing that. There were other Democratic introduced proposals to require the use of these interlock ignition devices for everyone who is convicted of a drunk driving offense, not just people who are second offense or who have a high enough blood alcohol level on first offense or who refuse a breathalyzer test, as is the case now. There were additional things to impound vehicle registration for people who drive drunk and make it a crime for them to drive cars other than the ones that have been outfitted with the ignition devices if they're required. All that kind of stuff came up. It was proposed. It was proposed by Democrats that didn't even have a hearing. It just went down in flames. But even the bills that were proposed by Republicans with the bipartisan support did not fare well.
And Bill, just briefly before we let you go, do you have a sense about whether there is an appetite this time around in both chambers to pass some drunk driving legislation?
Well, Representative Ott told me that he intended to reintroduce this package of bills or pieces of this package, and I assume that that will happen. I know that Senator Carpenter is interested in advancing legislation regarding drunken driving. There's all kinds of proposals they're talking about. One thing is sobriety checkpoints. That's something that Mothers Against Drunk Driving have found are useful in other states to create sobriety checkpoints. So people no longer can assume that if they don't act impaired, they won't get in trouble. Everyone convinces themselves that they can drive perfectly fine. But if you know you can get busted just because they're out there stopping people and looking for people who have been drinking, it does have a deterrent effect. Now, whether Wisconsin will go that route is a whole different question. Politically, that has been anathema. It's been something that has been controversial and not embraced by the political leadership.
Bill, thanks a lot for stopping by.
Thank you.
That was Bill Leaders with the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Now we'll continue our conversation about drunk driving legislation with Democratic State Senator Tim Carpenter from Milwaukee. Senator Carpenter, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on such a gloomy day.
Well, let's talk about your co-sponsorship of the Darling and Drunk Driving legislation. Why did you choose to co-sponsor that particular package?
Well, it's an idea whose time has come actually a long time ago, and I tried to work in a bipartisan fashion. There were several bills out there. Bill did an excellent job of kind of summarizing the lay of the landscape. But I wanted to work because I understand we're in the minority. The Republicans control both houses and the governorship. And I knew in order to get something passed, I'd have to work with Senator Darling, Representative Ott, any Republicans that want to really take a bite out of drunk driving. And so I co-sponsored their bills. Some of them I was the only Senate Democrat on. And so I realized in order to accomplish the goal that I hear it from a lot of folks at town hall meetings, every town hall meeting is doing something about our lax drug driving laws. So my door is open for business for any Republican, anything we can do to do something about drunk driving.
Now, you've had personal experience with the existing drunk driving laws in Wisconsin and your father. What happened?
Yes, one of the bills that passed on a voice vote, and I give the Assembly a heck of a lot of credit, they passed a bill on a voice vote that simply requires someone who's been charged with drunk driving to have them actually appear in court. My dad was an alcoholic and had a big drinking problem and went in for treatment several times. And there's a statistic, by the time you're stopped for drunk driving, you've probably been out there drinking and driving at least 100 times. That's the statistics according to MAD. Well, it happened to my dad 15 years ago, got stopped for drunk driving. And the thing that made a big difference for him is when he got stopped, I talked to him and said, I will help you. I will do everything. But my dad served in the Navy, and when he had to go to court and look at an authority figure, which he respected the law, he, you know, was in front of a judge, and that changed his life completely. He gave up drinking, you know, was sober the rest of his life. And I really do believe having a person show up in court in sort of a shaming mechanism and let them know how important it is. And it doesn't have a fiscal note. It just makes common sense to have people to sort of stand up and right their wrong.
Just got done talking to bill leaders about the failure of a lot of drunk driving legislation in the legislature. What is your sense about why this has been an uphill battle?
Well, there are a couple of reasons. I think some of it has to deal with the urban-rural split. I think everybody understands the number of binge drinkings, drunk driving. We're the only state in the nation where it's not a misdemeanor for drinking and driving. That was one of the other bills that came up that would say, if your blood, you were stopped on your first offense, we tried to compromise, and your blood alcohol level was 0.15, which is double the legal drinking or the drinking level of 0.08, that you would be considered, a misdemeanor. So we tried everything in our powers to bring things forward, but for some reason, I don't know if it was assembly did a great job. I don't know if it was some of the members of the Senate that were up for re-election that didn't want to take these votes because of the Tavern League or whatever, but we failed miserably in the Senate on doing something that Wisconsinites want us to do.
Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald has said there isn't consensus about whether toughening penalties actually works. What would you say to that?
Well, I think what we have to do is send signals. I think if we, the legislature, turns a blind eye to the problems of drunk driving in Wisconsin, I think that sends a pretty strong signal. And again, the thing of people knowing that they can go out drinking and their chances of being caught are minuscule. I think if you raise the penalties and you went ahead and, for example, Bill mentioned, which I support, safety checkpoints, having those out. I want to have, let's say, a pilot program in my area in Milwaukee County that the sheriff or the police department could set something up with safety checkpoints to go ahead and send signals and let people know that drinking and driving is not tolerated. And so I think the biggest thing is I know people talk about cost. There are a lot of things we can do that don't cost a lot of money, but we just can't sit on our hands and do nothing. In fact, we're going the opposite way. We have a bill that I sponsored. There's a alcohol that's coming out, alcohol in a powdered form that will be marketed sometime this summer, and including in Wisconsin, and that's going to add more problems with drinking and driving. You have that situation. The governor signed a bill that people in grocery stores will now be able to get hard liquor samples. And so all of these things are happening that are pushing us, sliding us back and making it the possibility of drunk driving worse. And we're not doing anything positive. We're taking a step back into the dark ages.
We're speaking with Wisconsin Senator Tim Carpenter from Milwaukee about failed attempts to toughen Wisconsin's drunk driving legislation.
April is Alcohol Awareness Month, and we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think Wisconsin needs tougher drunken driving laws? What would you like to see change, if anything? What would you say to Wisconsin lawmakers on this issue? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
It's Alcohol Awareness Month, and we're continuing our conversation with Wisconsin Senator Tim Carpenter about drunken driving laws in the state. Wisconsin has the highest rate of drunken driving in the country, and last legislative session, virtually all bills aimed at toughening drunken driving laws failed.
We'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Does Wisconsin need tougher drunken driving laws? What would you like to see changed, if anything? Would you like to see things like sobriety checkpoints? Call 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We go to our callers now. We've got Kurt on the line in Milton. Hi, Kurt.
Hello.
Hi, what do you think?
Hi. Well, I've got a perspective on this that I think kind of clears it all up, and I've talked to some of my elected officials about it. I'm a retired military officer. Every officers club and NCO club in the world has a machine as you leave where you can put in a dollar and check your blood alcohol level. I think probably the reason that you're not getting a lot of support from maybe the general populace and some of these things is separate out the hardcore people who really have a problem from people who go to a wedding or they go to dinner or this or that, and it's like, well, we don't want to drive drunk. We don't want to be over the limit. But it's hard to tell at that point. So if you don't have a way to tell where you are, it's kind of like having a bank account that has very serious fees if you overdraw, but no way to check your account balance.
Got it. And thank you, Kurt. Appreciate that perspective. And Senator Carpenter, would people self-regulate better if there were opportunities like that at public places?
Well, I think I think anytime you promote public's awareness of drinking and driving and what buzz driving is and things of that nature, it's great. I know there was a machine out there that people were talking about at bars where you could blow into a machine and find out your blood alcohol level. My concern with that would be you don't know how accurate it would be. And the second thing is I could see people being stupid and playing games to see how drunk they could get. And so if bringing it up can somehow, and we don't need a change in state law for that, but if people wanted to try and do that and took it seriously, I certainly would be open to something of that nature of more public information about what it is.
All right. Well, thank you for that, Kurt. And earlier, Senator Carpenter, you mentioned safety checkpoints and how you would be open to that in Milwaukee, for instance. What do you think about the argument that some people make that you're somehow affecting the people who are not drinking, who are doing the right thing, and you're putting the burden on them?
Well, it'd be the same thing. I'm glad you brought up that point. It'd be the same thing of doing checks before you go on an airline. We know what happens when, some people are going onto airplanes carrying things they shouldn't. We know the threats with that. And so when you get on a flight, you give up certain, rights, I guess, to have the better safety of your flight. It's the same thing. If someone's getting behind a couple ton vehicle driving drunk, and you go ahead and have an area, and you have to do this. I want to make it local control, let it be a pilot program, have local support, let people know. It could be like on St. Patrick's Day. It could be the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, New Year's Eve, amateur nights, I guess you could say, and have that out there. And again, if people know the chances of being stopped are greater, I think they'll calculate in their mind and say, geez, I don't want to take that risk. But right now, I would argue that it is our laws are lax enough that right now it doesn't deter enough people from drinking and driving.
Well, 38 states and D.C. have sobriety checkpoints. Do you have a sense how it's working in other states?
Well, I've actually been stopped at a couple of sobriety checkpoints around the country, and I know people, I'm going to get, nasty messages in the office about supporting this and whatever, but I found they were very professional. They have to follow constitutional guidelines, and I found it actually refreshing that when you're driving around and it have to be later at night, I felt comfortable. It's just like going on a plane. I feel more comfortable going on an airplane knowing that other people are on the plane aren't going to be stupid. And so if you have something out there, and I've heard from Illinois, Georgia, California, that they're all effective ways, and I can guarantee you that it will reduce the drunk driving rates. Because, again, more people are getting the message that it's not okay to drink and drive.
We're going to go next to Cheryl, who's joining us from Middleton. Cheryl, hi. Cheryl, are you with us? Okay, not hearing her, so we're going to go to Joshua in Oshkosh. Hi, Joshua.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to share a story and then I guess like an opinion that I would like to see maybe reformed or changed. I have an older brother. He was 33, and he happened to get a DUI when he was 21. Unfortunately, 3 years ago, he happened to get a second one, so almost 10 years apart. And I guess one of the laws in Wisconsin says that he is mandatory, has to go to jail for, I think it was 2 weeks. And I think he spent about a total of 3 weeks in a county jail while the process was being completed. Well, in the time, they ended up losing his job because he was, you know, obviously absent for 3 weeks. And then the penalty was the jail time, fines. He lost his license, and then he had to attend, parole meetings and then, an alcohol counseling class. He had a lot of trouble doing it because they took his license, so he couldn't get to work. He ended up taking, a part-time painting job to help pay for the fines, and they wouldn't give him a license to find a better job so he can get to it until he paid the fines. And then he couldn't even get to a good chunk of the parole meetings and the alcohol counseling meetings. So I'd like to see the reform go in the way that it kind of addresses the issue and not so much the penalties.
All right. Thank you, Joshua. So, Senator Carpenter, are the laws, even the existing laws, too punitive? Should they be more focused on treatment instead?
Well, we can have laws on the books, but it's actually ultimately up to the judges to go through and decide what justice is and measure the law against the individual. I don't know the particulars of if someone was injured, the blood alcohol level was at what point. And usually when, unfortunately, when things happen with drinking and driving, there are multiple things going on. You might have a child in the car, not having you suspended or revoked license, no mandatory, no automobile insurance proof. So, and knowing the particulars, I would guess that there must have been a lot going on for that type of penalty. We have drug courts, we have veterans courts, and I know at least in Milwaukee County, judges are willing to go out of their way and help someone who really wants to redeem themselves and change their life. So I do believe there is treatment options and also a restorative justice and people willing to help people out of this trap of drinking and driving.
Joshua, thank you for that call. And just briefly, Senator Carpenter, as we wrap up, what, if any, drunk driving legislation is planned for the coming session, and do you think it'll have support?
I saw, again, kudos to Representative Ott. He started circulating a couple bills. One was the appearing in court bill, and I think he and Senator Darling will be circulating them again. What I'll do is I serve on the Senate Transportation Committee. The drunk driving bills came through that committee in the Senate. We had public hearings and it passed, but I'll start working with the newer legislators. There's quite a bit of turnover to try and get them on board, try and work in a bipartisan fashion of getting something done.
And we leave it there. Senator Carpenter, thank you so much for joining us today. We've been speaking with Senator Tim Carpenter from Milwaukee about moves to toughen drunken driving legislation in Wisconsin's legislature. April is Alcohol Awareness Month, and Wisconsin has the highest rate of drunken driving in the country.